It's my great, great honor to introduce Anat Hoffman. They say that Marx said religion is the opiate of the masses, by which I think he meant that religion lets you be content, make do with what the world is. And I don't think Judaism is actually that kind of religion. Judaism is a religion of tikkun olam, a religion where the rabbis come and make takanot, create a reality that betters things for everyone. Always in dialogue with the status quo. And one of the things that I personally struggle with a lot as a Jewish leader is when's the right moment to decide that it's time for there to be women rabbis, or to decide to go up against the powers that be. And whenever I'm thinking, gosh, is it time to push? I think, well, Anat Hoffman will push. And I think that she's really an inspiration for us, as one of the people who is not afraid to ruffle feathers of the establishment, to really change the status quo, to really see how things are meant to be, and to work in that that direction. Anat was named Person of the Year by Haaretz in 2013. And by the Jerusalem Post, she's listed as she's one of the five most influential Jews for forcefully and successfully bringing the issue of women's rights at the Kotel to the forefront of world Jewry. Anat herself is a native Israeli who had served for many years on the city council and has in recent years been the director of the Israel Religious Action Center, which for me also as a high school kid, I remember looking up to that. Oh, someday, I want to be involved with IRAC and the Religious Action Center, which is the reform arm of social activism. Anat is a major player in the world. It's really a great honor that you've come. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
What a great introduction. But, I'm actually done, because all I need to have at the end of my presentation is for a man to stand up and say, I want to hold a luncheon in honor of my non-Jewish friend who died, and I'm not sure there's going to be enough rice. And please come. If I could hear that, then I don't need to give my presentation. Very good. I love Pardes. Pardes is paradise for me. Do you know that paradise comes from Pardes? And the reason it is coming from Pardes is because it's a place with lots of water. We're obsessed with water in our culture, in our language. And Pardes is where citrus grow. And Israel's very rich with citrus, except one citrus that we don't have in Israel. What citrus is really missing? Let's do a...
Lime.
How can you have a decent guacamole without lime? Why don't we have lime? Let's start a movement. Lime in Israel now. Why not? Pomelo, we're world champions. Lime, no, why? It makes no sense. But, Pardes is a place of plenty, and if there were 8 days a week, I am telling you here and now, I would spend the eighth day in Pardes. I love the atmosphere here. I've been following Pardes for a long, long time. Wonderful people come out of here. This is unique. This is this is almost as rare as the Jerusalem Municipal Zoo. And if you've been there, you'll see there are miracles over there as well. And in the presence of the wild animals, Jerusalemites act like human beings. It's really very nice at the zoo. So the Biblical Zoo is also a rare place. Like, here, why don't you take all of you to the zoo and see how reality, later if you ask me a question about that, I would show you how everything that is, it's a parallel universe to what's happening in Jerusalem. But I will make outrageous statements for like 25 minutes, and then I want to hear you. I've heard me before, so really I'd like to hear what you have to ask or remark. I invite you all to join my newsletter. Does anybody read you read my newsletter? Is it any good? It's good, you see. I'll give you the $10 on the way out. But it's a way for me to contact you every week. And there's a pen there, no? There was a pen. Okay. It's a very short text and usually funny. And it's about things that just happened this week. And the reason I'm so interested in you signing up is because every few weeks I ask you to do an action item. I ask you to sign a petition, write a letter, and these letters do matter, because when you go into the minister's office and he says, do you know any emails I got on this issue? And I say, yes, 18,344, because they all go through me. That's pretty good. So it's a way for you to become helpful. And also it will increase your diet of what's happening in the world of religion and state in Israel. I'm a native Jerusalemite. I was born in Rehavia. The reason that I have an American accent is because I went to a language lab. Actually, the reason is that I failed English in Israel. I wasn't able to pass my matriculation, my bagrut, because I couldn't get English into my head for love or money. And without English, you don't have a bagrut. But I was Israel's swimming champion. I told you I'm obsessed with water. And at UCLA, they couldn't care less about my grades. They wanted my times in the 100 and 200 freestyle, the 200, 400 medley. I have an American education. I went to UCLA. And then the first year, I attended a language lab where I've practiced. Swimmers do know how to do that. I practiced to obliterate my Israeli accent. And if I have alcohol, back it comes big time. So you should know it is possible to get rid of your accent completely if you are in an environment that actually allows it. Those of you who are struggling with Hebrew, just saying, it is possible. And I pass, at least when I'm not tired and not intoxicated, I can pass as a Californian, which I am not. I could have chosen a Southern drawl or a Bostonian accent. I chose California. But it does show up here and there. But I'm just saying, it is possible, since you are struggling with a language, I can tell you there are language labs, and it is possible. At UCLA, of all things, I've learned lots of interesting stuff. I learned meat cutlery. I learned jazz appreciation, homosexuality in Western civilization, prostitution, and you do learn a lot of other things in UCLA, but the thing I would say impressed me the most is that I learned about Reform Judaism. I had no idea there's another way to be Jewish. I thought the way we are taught here is the only way. I didn't like it, and that was it. I really came to America believing that I'm an Israeli, and the Jews have an issue with their, lame identity. They need to do all these activities as Jews, but we Israelis, we do Israeli things. And I started the Israeli student organization. And in that organization, the first decision we made was, we will not do Jewish things, we'll do Israeli things. Anyone who's been in Israel more than a week should not be shocked by this. So, okay, what are the Israeli things we're going to do? The list is short. Because half of us hates folk dancing. There's no hummus fit for human consumption in Los Angeles. I'm saving you a lot of time. What could we do? So I was forced to meet the rabbi of UCLA, Hillel Rabbi. And Chaim Seisler Feller, who's still around, I walk in his office and he says, are you the Israeli champion? I said, yeah. So you must have very developed lungs. I said, okay. I wasn't very keen about meeting a rabbi. Not that I met a rabbi when I lived in Jerusalem, but they get a bad rap in the media, and I never thought I'd actually like any of them. He seemed, his whole office was peculiar. His wife is a sex therapist, and some of her books were in his library. So it was very awkward for a Jerusalemite secular to go into his office. And then he said, did you ever blow shofar? What am I going to tell him? I've never been to shul. I said, no. My Jewish education ended in kindergarten, like many other Israelis. You ask an adult Israeli, what do you do in Shavuot? And he answers you like he's a four-year-old. We eat cheese. Okay, and what else? We eat fruit. Okay. It ended, and it really did end at age 5. He said, why don't you blow shofar for us? I said, why? He said, let's try it. He takes the shofar off the shelf, he gives it to me, I blew on it, it squeaked, and he said, I'm a real talent. And he gave me a book. Since some of you are rabbis to be, you should know Chaim Seidlerfeller just did his thing. He gave me a book. The book is Days of Awe. Those of you who read before the Chagim, it's an excellent book to read. It's all sorts of little vignettes, little agadot from mostly Hasidut about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippurim. It was reading this book in English in America that I figured that Jews don't drink on Yom Kippur. I knew about the eating bit. I didn't know about drinking. That's hard. And it was reading it in English that I realized that I never read it in Israel. The book was written in Israel. My mother is the first daughter of Kibbutz Ramat Rachel. Kibbutz Ramat Rachel is, you know, it's the only kibbutz in the Jerusalem city limits. When my grandparents, who are founders of the kibbutz, wanted to call her Rosa, it was Agnon himself, Agnon, the author who wrote Days of Law, who walked across from Telpiot to Ramat Rachel and said, Rosa ze lo Ivrit. Rosa is not Hebrew. My mother is the first Varda of Israel, 1930. So I knew Agnon, I know Chemdat, I know Emunah, I know his family, I went to school with his grandchild, never read his book. I read it in English, in America. And I went to shul on Yom Kippurim, and I didn't want to read the Machzor. There's a limit. I have some pride. So I read Days of Awe. When these people sat down, I read Days of Awe. When these people sat up, stood up, I read Days of Awe. And they all saw me as a super Jew. Why? Why, when this Israeli walks into the shul for the first time ever, they think I'm a super Jew? Because I pronounce chet and reish correctly. That's it. So you guys know, speaking perfect Hebrew and being in any way relating to your Jewish identity are two separate disciplines. There are 1.2 million Israeli Arabs who speak better Hebrew than most of the Reform rabbis of North America. So what? They're not Jewish. Speaking Hebrew is one discipline, knowing Judaism another. The two do not mix necessarily. So I was seen as a super Jew, even though I didn't know if Shema Yisrael ends with Shema Yisrael Adonai Elohechem or Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu. The fact that I can conjugate the verb doesn't mean I understand any of it. This is true for many Israelis. The ignorance of Israelis is immense. Are you aware of that? Yes, okay. Just so we know. So I sat up, sit down, and fasted for the first time, because I didn't feel like eating like a pig while all these people actually fast. And being hungry and thirsty and the music and the singing and being super Jew and blowing shofar at the end meant something to me. And I wrote my friends in Israel that I actually went to shul on Yom Kippur. And then there was an avalanche of letters from Israel. What? Are you going to shave your head? Are you going to be crazy? Are you going to go... No! I said, there's another way to be Jewish. You don't realize there's a choice. And we sat there, men and women, together. I blew shofar. Who knew? So this is, I think, one of the best things I got from my American education. This and another course I was forced to take because I'm a foreign student, American Government and Constitution. And I got to meet the American Constitution, which I think is a delightful, divine, wonderful, inspiring document. And those of you who were raised under that constitution, I wish we had one. And as border police told me in Bangor, Maine, I arrived there at 4 in the morning getting into the United States. I'm saying that I'm going to study constitution in America. And he says, I hear you don't have a constitution in Israel. Why don't you take ours? We don't use it that often. Okay, so... you should hold on to this wonderful document. I know America is not the paradise thing. It ought to be, but it is an inspiring, wonderful document that I wish I would be unemployed if Israel had one. Anyway, so these are the two gifts I got from America. The understanding that there are more than one, there's There are many ways to be Jewish, and that basically the state of Israel, with its misguided policy, giving all religious affairs to one minority group that is becoming more and more extreme, more and more closed as they get more and more power, this has denied me the ability to enjoy Judaism. Now that's a sin, that's a crime, that's a very bad thing. Who's going to teach Judaism in secular schools? Who? The beard? Hell no. The parents are going to go crazy because the beard is going to go in, say something about Shabbat, but also comment about how mom and dad observe Shabbat. And what kind of profession mom has anyway? And what does your dad do? What? You know, this, they're not going to allow it to go into the schools. Reform conservative rabbis are not recognized in Israel as rabbis. Why is that? Because the institutions they go to, the Hebrew Union College, the Jewish Theological Seminary, are not recognized in Israel as institutions of Jewish learning. Here comes a Hebrew word, chutzpah. Chutzpah, the Pope recognizes HUC. Every educational institution in the world recognizes the Jewish Theological Seminary. How dare the State of Israel not recognize thousands of rabbis all over the world? This is craziness. We got to change. It's got to change. We do agree that it's got to change. Let's compete in the field of rabbis. You're afraid of competition? Who's a person who's afraid of competition? You know, I swam for Israel in 300 international competitions. I never won a medal, ever. I was Israel swimming champion in 9 separate events. In the Israeli nationals, I always came first. But there was no competition. I knew Dorit, I knew Shulamit, I knew Ivona, we all knew each other, to the point that I knew where Ivona comes out to breathe, and that's I give her a little bit of a drink on the way. And we knew each other completely, intimately. We trained together. Where did I break the Israeli record? Not in the nationals. On those competitions where I came in last. Yeah, in Holland and in Reykjavik. Do you believe that the Iceland team beat us? And they have a geyser. They swim when the geyser is out. God knows when do they swim. They've never seen the sun. And they beat us. We, with 24-hour... forget it. Anyway, I'm just saying, you set records when you have competition. And the fact that the State of Israel has made only Orthodox rabbis count, only male Orthodox count, that is impoverished Judaism in Israel. It causes to be on the verge of bankruptcy. Israelis are, I think, 60,000. Last year was 75,000. Young Israelis go to India to find themselves. Why would a Jewish kid from here find himself as spiritually when he's wearing a purple skirt and has an earring in his ear dancing on the Goa beach? What is missing here? What's wrong with the system? Competition would do good to Orthodoxy, to Israel, to Judaism, and don't be afraid of competition. I'm speaking as one who always lost abroad, but that's where I set the records. You know that 60,000 young Haredi guys don't go to the army. Instead, they are studying in the yeshivot. You know that in the year 2020, a quarter of the student body of Israel will not be studying core curriculum at all. This is boys who go to ultra-Orthodox institutions. They will not study life skills, civics, English, math, science, any of that. They will be unemployable in the modern world. How does this make sense in any possible way? Economically, religiously, I look at the Talmud and I see that these guys were all in the yellow pages. Maimonides had a profession. I mean, he worked and he wrote the Yad HaZakah and Mishneh Torah and Shmona Pakim. You know what? If one of those 60,000 wrote Shmona Pakim or the Yad HaZakah, I say, okay. But can you mention one book of importance and weight that was written in the last 67 years here in Israel by an ultra-Orthodox guy? I can think of some great books. A non-Haredi like Amos Oz, a non-Haredi like Yehuda Michai, a non-Haredi like Daniel Rabikovich, Meir Shalev, you name it. There were some excellent, great writers. Not Haredi. So I think it's bad for them, too, not to be part of the of the world. And it's not the Jewish way. Yochanan HaSandlav, Hillel, I think Hillel was a surveyor, Shammai was a surveyor and Hillel was a builder. Everyone had, they worked. Working is all right. So I am putting a big question mark over the core curriculum issue, and that too we need to fight. I wanted to talk to you about women. Half the Jewish world. I might mention that I'm the chairperson of Women of the Wall. Raise your hand if you heard of Women of the Wall. Very good. Join us. We're every Rosh Chodesh at the Wall. It's famous. It's in every Jewish calendar. You can get wet with us on Tevet. Boy, did we get wet this week. This is the Women of the Wall Talit. It has Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah on all four corners. You think I'm a social activist. I'm a shmata salesperson. This costs $150. And this is how Women of the Wall support themselves, by having one subversive act support another. So if you ever thought of buying a talit in Israel, buy it from us, and half of the proceeds go to Women of the Wall, and men buy it too, as I found out when I explained to a group of 50 homosexuals who came to the gay parade, from San Francisco. I said, you know, one of them asked, do men buy it? And I said, well, an Israeli will not be seen dead in these colors. And they bought 50 talitot on the spot. So I stand corrected. Men buy it too. So the Women of the Wall are trying to express their religious feelings at the wall for the last 27 years. It's a group that has a very modest goal. We want to perform the four T's. Talit, Torah, Tfilah, and Tfilin. That's it. And we've been trying to do this for 27 years. And some of us were arrested for breaking the 13th regulation of the law of holy places. The 13th regulation is, the other regulations are, don't piss on the wall, don't spit on the wall, no graffiti on the wall, no slaughtering of animals at the wall, no begging at the wall. No. And there's the 13th one, one cannot perform a religious act that offends the feelings of others. Anyone performing such an act, which is contrary to local custom, is guilty and is punishable by 1 year imprisonment. I have a criminal record. Most of all of it is breaking the 13th regulation. Blowing shofar at the wall. Heinz Seidlerfeller didn't know what he got me into. Blowing shofar at the wall, lighting a menorah at the wall, wearing a talis at the wall, saying Shema Yisrael at the wall. All these things are all punishable. This is wrong. It is wrong to treat the wall, which is an open, a national site, archaeological site, religious site of Israel, as an ultra-Orthodox synagogue. In the beginning, when the partition just was erected on the 14th of April, 1968, it was 30 meters for the men and 30 meters for the women. But now it is 48 meters for the men and 12 for the women. And the number of activities that women are allowed to do would have been nothing. No, the long list. The number of activities allowed for women when Women of the Wall started in the 80s, was very, very limited. In fact, I have a letter from the Rabbi of the Wall at the time, Rabbi Meir Yehuda Getz, and he says, "Sister, you are best praying with your mouth shut, your lips moving, and your voice not heard. Take example from Chana, first chapter of Shmuel. This is the best way befitting a woman. Talit? What?" I met him and he said, "My mother never wanted it. My wife doesn't. My daughter doesn't. What's wrong with you?" His world was these women. His daughter, his wife, and his mother. And I don't think he, you know, my grandfather was somewhat, he believed that I'm a swimmer, but he never came to a competition. So he one day told me, "You really dive with the head first? Is it possible?" Like, he's never seen a swimming competition, so he doesn't know. That was Getz. He just couldn't perceive that we have mini'im tehoim. How would you say that?
Pure motives. Pure intentions.
Nachon, exactly. Pure motives. And the Chronicle, I can tell you that the last 27 years, women of the wall have constantly been trying to explain their motives. You are doing it because you want to provoke. You are doing it because you don't have enough sex at home. You are doing it because you just want to spite. Are you putting on tefillin every day that you can put it here? All these things that are never asked of any man who's doing the same on the other side of the partition. And I must tell you, if I was asked, I'm an old hand at provocation. If anyone asked me, what is the best way to provoke at the wall? I will not recommend coming with a group of modestly dressed women at 7 in the morning and holding a halachic prayer. That would not be our number one provocation. I can think of some things that would really make people jump. This is not one of them. And to do it for 27 years, in Intifada, in the snow, in the Khamsin, at all times, pregnant, doesn't qualify as a provocation to me. It qualifies as Mesirut Nefesh and Yirat Shamayim. Ivrit? Anglit? Mesirut Nefesh, total commitment.
Selflessness.
And Yirat Shamayim.
Fear of heaven.
They let the riffraff in. How are you? Okay. I'm done. This is it. Now it's your time to ask questions. I have lots of stuff here that I can mention, and this is all for you to take. But basically, I wanted just to warm you up to what kind of conversation we're going to have here so you have a good indigestion before lunch. Okay, Baksha.
I'm curious about your previous efforts to move, or maybe they're current, to move from the women's section to Robinson's Arch. And the reason I'm concerned is because it seems to me to leave behind, Women of the Wall was always a multi-denominational organization, and it seems to me the move from the women's section of the Kotel to the Robin's Arch area leaves behind the Orthodox women who were your members and your fellow daveners, because they will not daven in an area that is egalitarian. So Why would Women of the Wall want to leave them behind?
Well, since the whole factual infrastructure is wrong, I can't answer this question. So let's look at the facts. You're right. Women of the Wall are from all denominations. This is one of our greatest achievements, that we were able to break the partitions between us, even to the point that we were able to write a sidul. We fought over every word for 6 years, but we have a sidul, one text, that we are reading together, Reform, Orthodox, and Conservative. We are not interested in moving into Robinson's Arch. We are forced into Robinson's Arch. We are negotiating with the government under what conditions are we going to be willing to go there, The government is gung-ho on offering the liberal movements of the world, the Reform and Conservative movement, and all the federations of North America. Not sure you are aware, it's not just the Reform Conservative, it's also the JAFNA, the Jewish Federations. It's a very big, powerful group, offering them a partition-free wall. And that negotiation is going on. And Women of the Wall have to decide, are we going to be an afterthought after this negotiation ended? Or are we going to lead this whole group into a negotiation that is successful and answers our needs? And on the question, what does an NGO do when the Prime Minister calls you and says, I want to negotiate? I'm on the side that says that when the Prime Minister asks you to come and talk, you go and talk. Those organizations that say, oh, there is nothing to negotiate with the Prime Minister of Israel, they end up having their annual meeting in a phone booth. Because unless you, NGOs in the end have to compromise. The question is, how much compromise, and how far can we move the powers that be? 27 years of non-negotiating have not brought us far enough. And negotiating with the Prime Minister, I have a parking spot at the Prime Minister's office. We are negotiating there a lot. And we negotiated in good faith. We were willing to re-examine every one of the things we believe in. And both sides have changed. So here is the vision that we had. Relax. The negotiations fell apart, not because of us. The government cannot deliver. we are seen as people who dealt in good faith. This will help us, because the number one negotiator was Avichai Mandelblit, today the government secretary, tomorrow Israel's attorney general. So we did good. We paid a price. Like any NGO, the more radical, staunch group in us walked out. It's a miracle that it took 25 years, that we were always able to hold together for 25 years. But yes, I respect the people who felt negotiation is not something we're willing to do. I lived my whole life negotiating. And in fact, when I look at the achievements I've had in my social activism, they're all fruit of negotiation. Good negotiation. And marriage is one long negotiation. And love is what remains after you know the truth. So I can tell you that doing that hard thing made women of the wall play hardball with the big guys. And staying on our side and saying, the women's section or bust would have left us as a little afternote in the trash can of history. So we are... But negotiation failed. But let me just say what we came to, because this is so wonderful. The idea was that Israelis will be presented with a choice. You come to the wall. On your left is the ultra-Orthodox plaza with its partition, with its Sifrei Torah, and with the 13th regulation rule. One cannot perform a religious act contrary to local custom, which offends the feelings of others. That's what happens there. Right next to it, on the other side of the Mugrabi Bridge, a egalitarian plaza. No partition, but three separate areas on three separate levels, designed by Michael Arad, the architect who won the Twin Towers memorial. And women of the wall can have one of those plazas. Men do not come. It doesn't have a wall, but it's clear that this is an intact area for women only. We don't need a fence. We can be on our own in the plaza and feel that and know that we are not a mixed minyan. We're very careful on that issue. And we are going to get 29 million shekel to begin with, 10 million shekel every year. We're going to hire our own ushers. Our ushers will not pounce on every female 3 years or older and make her wear a shmata. We will not stop a bar mitzvah for the deaf, as the rabbi does today. We will welcome a person with a seeing eye dog, which is not allowed at the wall today. We will allow dancing. We will allow singing. We will give talitot to women who want and don't have. We will give out siddurim. The Reform Sidhu, the Conservative Sidhu, the Women of the Wall Sidhu. We will not have musical instruments on Shabbat because it may interrupt people in the other plaza that this may interfere with their prayer. We thought of, there's a 68-page negotiation result, which is wonderful. I'm very proud of this document. It shows that we were able to present the Jewish people with a real option. The government of Israel has now withdrawn this offer. Not us. We went along.
Why have they withdrawn?
Because the building of these three areas is massive, and it's 17 meters from the center of the Mosque of Omar and the Temple Mount. And the feeling is that the Jordanians and the Muslim world is going to see that development as the Jews building a launching pad to take over the Temple Mount. If the Muslim leadership was here, I would say, guys, don't you realize that the people who will be coming to this egalitarian plaza are actually a buffer from those who want to take over? But the situation now can't be done. But I've seen... How does he say? I have seen the promised land. I might not get there with you, but it is there, and we have constructed it together with the Prime Minister of Israel and his staff in the Prime Minister's office. Wouldn't give up on that.
Is that why Rabbi Moshevich did not allow a lighting of the Temple?
Rabbi Rabinovich not allow a woman to light the Chanukiah? And why did the Attorney General of Israel write him that this is illegal? Ah, the Attorney General of Israel is part of the negotiation that we're holding. He has changed in the last 2 years. You realize what this... This is something that doesn't happen often, that you get to talk to the real people that really make decisions and change them. He doesn't want a woman to say, Levarech b'shem uvemalchut, to say the name of God on the mic, on the loudspeaker. He said to the Attorney General, I'm willing for a woman to be a wallpaper. I'm willing for a woman to light a candle and give it to the man who will light the avukah. And our, get this, on the second candle, our Minister of Gender Equality, we saw her, Gila Gamliel, lit the candle and gave it to Yitzhak Herzog. Gender equality, shame on you. Yeah, so we've written a report about every one of those nights. The rabbi promised full equality, and we counted two women, Tzipi Livni and Gila Gabriel, who were there to give the candle to the man who blessed the candles. They did it on the porch, not at the main menorah of Israel, on the porch. If you want to see that there are women on the porch, you can't, because at the moment of candle lighting, he turns on the big spotlights. So you really can't see it. We are trying to take photos, you can't. They're up there on the porch, and they're holding a candle, and they're not saying anything. So the three other women he invited, the Chashkalit of Misrad HaOtzar, Karmit Flug, the head of Bank Israel, and the Netzivat Shevut Batei HaSohar, all three, we contacted them, and we said, don't be a wallpaper, and they refused to come. Next year, another round, our report will be published exactly then. We'll have a new Attorney General. Who is that going to be? Avichai Mendelblit. And Avichai Mendelblit realizes what this means. 2 years of negotiating with Rabbi Rick Jacobs of the Union of Reformed Judaism and Julie Schoenfeld from the Conservatives, and Jerry Silverman from the Jaffna, and Natan Shalansky from the Jewish Agency, and the Women of the Wall, who are the only ones around the table that have two representatives. He realizes that he must have women light candles next year. So I think we have... It's not moving fast. I started this when I was a single person. I'm now a grandmother, okay? It's not fast, but it is moving. And it's moving because we dared to ruffle feathers, not of the powers that be, ruffle feathers of our sisters, ruffle feathers in the family. That's what takes courage. Not the fight against the powerful people. That's easy. The hardest battles I've ever had were in the bedroom, in the kitchen, and in the living room. And any social activist knows that, particularly if she's from the female persuasion.
Why do you think that the rabbi of the wall, whatever his name is,
Rabinovich,
why do you think he will comply with the orders of the next attorney general when he wouldn't comply with the orders of this one with respect to women lighting at the wall?
It's an excellent question. Why do I think? Because he's suffering attrition. Number one, he is the chairperson of the Western Wall Heritage Foundation. The budget of the Western Wall Heritage Foundation is somewhere between 75 to 150 million shekel a year. He's about to build a six-story building right in the plaza. He is now needing hundreds of millions from the Ministry of the Treasury. The budget line of the Western Wall Heritage Foundation is not in the Ministry of Religious Affairs. It's in the Prime Minister's office. Huh? Follow the money. It's in the Prime Minister's office. He can't afford to get them so pissed. So he's going to have to say that the Attorney General has forced his arm, and he has to let a woman say, Baruch Atah Adonai, and the word Adonai will be heard not by other people. He said to us, it's not that other people are so injured by it. The wall hears it. He knows what the wall wants to hear. He knows what the wall wants to see. And he knows for a fact the wall doesn't want to see us and doesn't want to hear us. He said it to the Supreme Court in 2000. It's the twilight zone. Okay, look, Sean.
Are you familiar with Rabbi Yair's minion?
No.
Maybe you don't know the name, but the minion that comes before you, you just around there.
Ah, those that jump up and down.
Yes.
Yeah, so, I know them.
Okay, so a lot of them are my friends. They're from the Yeshiva Otniel. I'm a writer.
Ah.
And the head of it went back to the States with Yair. And so a lot of times, there are different opinions of other guys there.
Do we bother you?
What?
Do we bother you?
No, not necessarily.
Oh, okay.
And actually, so I'm very much into Achaz. I grew up traditional, and I myself found myself in the creative world at some point. And then, as I was coming to where I'm now, I found the Nachlot group and whatnot. Anyway, so I kept saying, you know, I'm told this to my Haredi family and to other people. Let's say there is a problem. Let's just say you have a problem. I understand your concerns, whatever they are. But isn't the bigger concern that, like, we need Mashiach and we need to get together? Weren't all children of Yaakov, and he had 12 sons in 12 different ways?
And one daughter.
And can we come out of Egypt with 12 separate...
And how's that going?
How
is that convincing your family on that?
And other people, I started writing. Actually, there are some people you should just know about. One of them, his name forgets me for a moment, but he has a group called Machon Emet, where he writes an article to the Haredi institutions for a tell them the idea of Achdus. And
Achdut?
Yeah.
You heard of it then? And
no, I'm just translating Achdus.
I know that a lot of times that I always pray, especially on a Friday, when Rosh Chodesh on a Friday, that there should not be a scene, because usually the bigger scene on Friday when everybody has. And it was Rosh Chodesh Av, it was a Friday. And I said, you know what, I know something's going to happen. And I told the guys, let's say at least one Tehillim and try to get the Haredi people to our minyan. They don't want to dance and jump with us. We're just guys. There's less of a problem. But we also have a problem. We also, and not so many people wanted. And I saw the one guy in the front. So I said, and they saw that it was bothering. They were using the Tehillim to bother, to overdrain you guys. So the people in the Yair's minyan didn't really want, some of them didn't want to participate. So I said, okay, fine, I'm going to go to the source. I went to the guy, I found out who he was, and he was like a bunch of like 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, who, because they have all this energy, they didn't mean to hurt anyone, just being immature people. And I went to him and said, what are you doing? Like, I understand every single reason why. I told him my speech about Achdus and about before Tisha or whatnot. He got the hint. But people don't necessarily think what they're doing, if it's right, if it's wrong, whatever. And actually, that same day, I saw Rabinovich, and I said, listen, you know, I know you're concerned about the women on the wall, and maybe there is an issue, but, like, why don't we make a bigger minion of Achdus where everyone wants to come, with a focus, and not on Rosh Chodesh, the center. And he said, yeah, go to and if he says okay, then look, all right. I asked that rabbi,
Can you answer the question, Yisrael?
And a summary of the question.
Okay. So let's move on then.
No, it is a question. I'm building my question. I'm trying to
ask it. If you have a question, Yisrael, ask it now.
Ask it now? Don't succeed. In what ways, when how you can try to make things happen, more unity? Is there a way that both sides can?
I'm not even considering the option of not succeeding. That's not an option. if you look at, we're moving slow, but we're very tenacious and we're moving in the right direction. Our biggest day, as I said, the biggest pain that we've had was not from the powers that be, it was losing some of our wonderful, devoted friends who were not able to see the political opportunity that we had, and the majority of our board went with this opportunity, but we did lose by the wayside a few people that we really care about. But we're moving forward. You're asking me what would happen to my granddaughter, who is now 2 years old. She will have a bat mitzvah at the wall with a state-provided Torah, with a state-provided talit, with a state-provided everything. She'll be in 10 years. We're there. There is no doubt in my mind. And the reason is not because the Israelis are so gung-ho about this issue. It's because when I asked, who of you heard of Women of the Wall? This happens again and again, not just to me. The Prime Minister of Israel goes to America. He wants to talk about Iran. He wants to talk about terror. And there's always that one person, usually a woman. And she asks, what about the Women of the Wall? Every time, everywhere. His advisor, Yaakov Amidror, wrote a little booklet. It's called Women of the Wall as a Strategic Threat to Israeli Interests in North America. So we know the direction. Ken Baksha.
Do you consider that your activism is partially dedicated to convincing the Haredi world, or you're just out of this? You're doing your thing for your own?
No, I have no argument with the Haredi world. I understand exactly when you're given absolute power, absolute jurisdiction over religious affairs, absolute budgets. This morning, 22 billion shekel are being moved. So if you get that much power and you're given that, if I was given that, I'd use it too. My problem is not with them. My problem is with the state of Israel that has taken the keys, where are my keys? Taken the keys to the holiest site of the Jewish people and handed it out to one minority group that is becoming more and more extreme every year. That's the problem. My problem is not them at all. My problem is not that Rabinovich believes this way or another. My problem is that the people who fund him, who put him in his place, who allow him to run the Western Wall Heritage Foundation that has 15 Haredi men as members, have allowed this to go on. In Israel, we have some laws. You can't have a board with 15 Haredi men and call it a national foundation. You can't do that. I want in. That's the next Supreme Court petition. I think we're giving it in March. I'm going to ask to sit on the Western Wall Heritage Foundation. I will prove that I am a person of interest at the wall. I've been there 27 years. I have something to say. I want to be there. What would be the first thing I initiate on the first meeting of the new Western Wall Heritage Foundation? I will ask that we will start with the Dvar Torah, and it will go by rotation. First, Rabbi Rabinovich. Like that. Any other? Yes, please.
So I have really two questions, and they're short. Firstly, you spoke at length about women's issues, and I actually agree also on the larger perspective of religious change in Israel. But firstly, what would you answer to people who say you are upsetting the standards that we have? There are some standards, and if we don't have standards, you know all the different problems that can come when we don't have standards. There's that accusation. Secondly, I want to ask, why did you put on and why are you wearing a talit right now? Why did you do that? Why is I hope that it's not just such a simple explanation of you want to show it to us so we might buy it.
That too.
Yes, but you could have put it on and taken it off.
No, it's prayer comes in all sorts of forms. And I feel that standing with the wonderful students of Pandes today and talking about equality and challenging what's happening in Israel is a sort of prayer for me. And that puts me in the mood. And that's what I do. But your question about that what we are asking to do at this national area may be injurious to the feelings of others, everybody knows when we come. You can set your watch when we come. You don't want to hear women's praying out loud? Don't be there at 7 in the morning on the second day of Rosh Chodesh. 12 times a year, change your schedule. Let's share time.
Jews have always built structures in time, not in space. Share time. I'm asking for 11 hours a year. There are over 8,000 hours in a year. I'm asking for 11 of them. I'm not going to budge.
That was not really my question. My question was, what about the accusation? Less actually about women's issues, more about broader religious reform. What do you say to accusations that the changes you're making will, so to say, blur standards, reduce standards?
No, I think we argue about standards.
I mean, they don't have.
I don't know standards. I think Jews have always argued about standards. Sitting in City Council of Jerusalem with 18 ultra-Orthodox men who are representing the ultra-Orthodox community, I would occasionally survey them about different observances. There isn't one standard between the 18 of them. Everyone picks and chooses. Everybody has. There are many colors, many tones of black. There are 50 shades of black. And they are they pick and choose too. And I pick and choose too. And the most important thing, we are an argumentative people. We are complainers. We started right from Abraham. It's, you know, usually a new religion doesn't start with an argument over how many just people can be in Sodom. But that's how it begins, and that's how it continues. And the Talmud is one huge argument. We've always had a core, a live core of arguing. And if the Olympics were in Israel, that would be the sport we would have. Arguing. Where all this argumentation ended when the government of Israel handed one faction all the authority over all religious affairs. And it stunted Orthodoxy, and it's bad for Judaism and bad for Israel. And I refuse to accept the notion of chief rabbi. We never had a pope for a reason. We are not poping. Aselech Harav. You find your own rabbi. Do you know how they choose a chief rabbi in Israel? You want to get really disgusted? You look at what happened this year, almost by a fluke, we were able to stop Shmuel Eliyahu from being chief rabbi of Israel. A known racist, the chief rabbi of Tzfat, was almost the chief rabbi of Israel. The reason he is not is because we pushed the attorney general of Israel, Weinstein, who is not a very activist person, to go to all 150 voters of the chief rabbanut and say to them, the Israel Religious Action is going to challenge you personally if you vote for this racist as chief rabbi. And I, the attorney general, will not defend you. I am warning you now, you cannot vote for him. He is a racist. If it wasn't for that, they would have voted for him. And then he ran for chief rabbi of Jerusalem. And we had to fight that. And here we came to a woman in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Lynn Schusterman. Have you heard of Lynn Schusterman? Lynn Schusterman picked up the phone to Neil Barkat and said, I'm just reading the stuff the Israel Religious Action Center sent me of all these quotes of this racist. You want him as your chief rabbi in Jerusalem? One phone call from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Neil Barkat took his 28 votes and voted for someone else. Yeah?
I'm just curious how you think your battle over the past 25 plus years to change the status quo with the Western law, I understand the status quo was like an enshrined notion in Israel, how has that fueled, maybe unwittingly, activists who want to change the status quo on the Temple Mount or other holy places in Israel?
Aye, that's a fantastic question. Look, it must have, because our winnings, I'm sure that every time we won, more and more about the right for Chofesh Pulchan, freedom of
worship.
It certainly fed into it. And I believe in principle in the right of Jews to pray anywhere in Israel. And actually, I was a member of the ACRI, the Association of Civil Rights in Israel, when many years ago, Meir Kahana, thank you very much for this import from America, came to Israel and wanted to read the full book of Joshua, smite them, kill them, in the middle of Umm al-Fahim, one of Israel's largest Arab towns. And he wanted the ACRI to represent him because it required 1,500 police to stand around and protect the rabbi while he read. And ACRI decided that we're not going to represent him. And I resigned from the board of ACRI. And I represented him. And he did read the book of Joshua, and I believe in the right of rabbis to read the book of Joshua anywhere they damn please. However, I am staunchly against incitement for violence or hate against the Arab minority. Reading the book of Joshua and the freedom of rabbis to read what they want from the Bible or Talmud, that we use. Writing on the letterhead of the city of Tzfat that anyone renting to an Arab is not welcome anymore in the minyan, that's incitement, and that is abusing his role as chief rabbi of Tzfat. So, be that as it may, that I believe in the right of all Jews to pray anywhere they want, I take seriously what every security minister has said in the last 48 years, that praying on Temple Mount is going to cause a possible world war with the Muslim world, and it's ill-advised. This is a fight we have with the neighbors. I'm not having fights with the neighbors. I have fights with my brother. My brother says, your voice distracts me, it offends the wall, and I refuse to allow you to pray out loud or wear your talit. And I think that you're doing it just to spite me for the last 27 years. This is something in the family. It's different. If Jews are allowed to pray up on the Temple Mount, women of the law will be up there. But I think it would be ill-advised because a world war, you know, I have all my children here. I don't want them suffering from a world war. Yes, Acha.
I've always been confused about jurisdiction over this. I understand that this group sets the rules, and then you go to the Prime Minister's office to negotiate the rules. But from a distance, they obviously don't have a halakhic leg to stand on. Whatever sodomizes they have about women are minhag shtut. Why do they continue? How do they continue? Is there no moderate religious authority? Is there no baked in to go and argue or have machloket about this issue? Because in a reasonable discussion, I just don't see it. I can't see it.
This is so far from being a halachic machloket. This is a territorial war about who sets the rules and who's in charge and who makes the wall what it is. And the rabbi recently published a book. I'm one of the few who actually read it. It's over 800 and some odd pages long. Kuf Lamed Aleph pages, because he doesn't use pages. And there are 700 photos there. Now, you need to be an acrobat. You need to hang yourself from the ceiling to take a picture of the wall and not have one photo of one woman. That really takes some activism. But he's done it. There are pictures about women. There's a one page. It says that women aren't advised, if they are menstruating, not to look at the Torah in the Haggadah. Not to look at the Torah in the Haggadah. Women are also advised, when they're menstruating, not to touch the wall. Okay? And that's it for women. The book reflects where Rabinovich is. He is a Haredi rabbi. I respect his Harediness. Where are my keys? He can't get the keys to the holiest site of the Jewish people, a national site that needs sensitivity. And of course, the Western World Heritage Foundation should be exactly that big thing you're talking about. It should be a place where we sit together, all 15 of us, representatives of the paratroopers who liberated the wall. They're also, I represent them. They went in too. Yes. The paratroopers and women of the wall and the reform and the conservative and the Ministry of Tourism and all sorts of interested parties and Sharansky. And we will solve problems. Oh, I promised you a word about the zoo. At the zoo, non-Jews and Jews, Orthodox and secular, sit together and run the zoo. And when the flamingos stopped didn't have eggs, we have 68 flamingos, they decided, in a bold act, that we will stop giving them beetroot to keep their feathers pink. They must have shrimp. Rabbis, on the board, shrimps only for flamingo consumption are brought to the zoo to feed our flamingo. No eggs. Then we sent Shmulik to San Diego. We are paired with San Diego. And Shmulik found that 68 is too small a flock. We paid hundreds of thousands of shekel, and we have mirrors around the are ponds, so they will look like they're more. No eggs. No eggs. And then, even with the shrimp and with the thing, in the end we spent over $1.5 million. We sent a lab in Geneva, a new lab of ornithologists, a feather from every one of our flamingos, and we have 68 boys. And this is why. when the zoo wanted to ask, are we going to open on Shabbat? The biblical zoo is closed on Shabbat. Or what is closed on Shabbat is the box office. In the parking lot, there is a truck without wheels. Every human in Jerusalem knows. You go to the parking lot, you buy a ticket in the truck, and you go into the zoo. The zoo is closed. The box office is closed. The truck is open. In the zoo, we have two eagles, Dashik and Yuda. Dashik and Yuda were displaying a few years ago nesting behavior, cleaning up. So we gave them a wooden egg, and Dashik sat on it. They're two male eagles. He sat on it. We exchanged the wooden egg with a real egg from Gamla, an extra egg. You know, they lay them two, but they can only raise one. And a beautiful eaglet was born. Takes 2 years to raise her. The fastidious, most clean nest you've ever seen. Dashik and Yuda are now raising their 8th baby together. While the stabbing in the gay parade, they too are having a wonderful family life. The head of the elephants department is a Arab from Jabal Muqabil. All the workers there are foreign workers from Thailand. When the baby Teddy was born, 325,000 kids wrote the zoo that labor has begun, because the zoo had a camera there and showed what are the 10 antecedents to labor. 325,000 kids were saying to the... We have an animal called a wombat from Australia. Mm-hmm. Next to it there is a sign, because of the ultra-Orthodox rabbis on them, that says, Dos is nicht chosir. And if you look at this zoo, you see that when you're interested in solving problems, you solve them. It's a place that everything that's right in the zoo is wrong in the Jerusalem municipality. But when you want to fix something, you can. And if we had good, well-meaning people sitting around the table at how to run the wall, every one of these things can be solved. Every one of them. Takes a little bit of goodwill, and it has to be not a territorial war. It has to be a conversation about compromise, because compromise is the only way we can stay married. Okay, so Israel is way too important to be left to Israelis, and did you all sign up so I can put you to work? Let me just say what I brought here. If you're interested in excluded, for God's sake, this is our last report about exclusion of women in the public sphere. I do not have a report for this year because I don't have enough material. This phenomena that was so bad 10 years ago is on its way out. The writing on the wall about racism in the internet, from here at 2 o'clock, I'm speaking at the Knesset about this report. This is your rights on flights. If a Haredi man refuses to sit with you at the airport, what do you do? I brought you lots of them because I want you to give it out at the airport. We're looking for a good case. We want to sue El Al. This is every Israeli bus. After we won the buses, this is in every bus. We sued bus drivers for not allowing women to sit in the front. We won in all 13 cases. The same applies to airplanes. Racism and gender in Israel. This is about how the incitement against Arab is focused on how they are after our sisters, they want to rape our mothers. That part for North Americans here is very familiar. This is the Israeli Declaration of Independence and some of our cases, LGBT, conversion, racism, all these cases. This is really worth having. And look at the cases and look at the declaration. Women talk about segregation in Israel, and this last one is our new Ushpizin. This year, we wanted to get into the Israeli Sukkah. 7 Arabs, Israeli Arabs, passed away, and how they contributed to Israel. So in the back of everyone, who was the Arab, and in the front is their picture, and you hang it in the Sukkah, And I'm proud to tell you that 2000 Sukkot had them. So this is a text that we are changing. Thank you so much for your attention.